I'm Leonard Lope. Welcome back to my show. If readers found Neil Gaiman's American Gods, his last novel for adults, hard to classify, then Anansi Boys, his latest, will leave them equally confused, but I suspect equally entertained. Mr. Gaiman has a way of balancing myths and stories of gods with the most commonplace scenes of the real world, and the book has just been published by William Morrow. If that weren't enough, Miramask, a new film for which he wrote the script, is opening tomorrow at the Landmark Sunshine on East Houston Street. Mr. Gaiman, who has won numerous writing awards and is listed in the Dictionary of Literary Biography as one of the top 10 living postmodern writers, joins me now. Very pleased to welcome you to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about the novel first. It's been described as a magical horror thriller, ghost romantic comedy family epic, although that leaves out the detective bits and much of the food. That's the way you described it.
Yes. Well, people say, what kind of a book is it? And they want you to say, well, it's a thriller. And you go, well, I actually got some thriller stuff in it. So I just tried to list everything that it probably was. It's I suppose, a screwball comedy with some scary bits in. It's whatever writers... There aren't a lot of writers that do that kind of thing anymore, but back in the 20s and 30s, you'd have people like Thorne Smith, who would write these wonderfully funny books that also had serious themes going on and would have scary, weird, odd bits and stuff. And it's one of those, whatever those were.
And Thorne Smith is one of the people who you dedicate the book to. You have an odd list. Zora Neale Hurston, Thorne Smith, P.G. Woodhouse, and Tex Avery, the great animator. Do they have anything in common other than they're all dead?
They're all dead, and they were all, in their own ways, very much inspirations for the book. Zora Neale Hurston, her collections of folklore were what originally turned me on to the whole Anansi story thing, these West African stories, how they came to America and to the Caribbean. P.G. Woodhouse, because I love how he put essentially farces together and would build these novels that were perfectly funny and in which every sentence was more or less a pleasure to read. Thorne Smith, I've already mentioned, he's a forgotten author who's these days only really remembered for Topper, but also wrote books with titles like The Nightlife of the Gods and I Married a Witch. He wrote The Passionate Witch, which then became I Married a Witch. And Tex Avery, because there was something about the book that felt to me at times like a Tex Avery cartoon.
So where American Gods was not funny, this book is, and that's something that you intentionally set out to do, to write something funny?
Oh, absolutely. American Gods, I mean, I love American Gods, but it was a very big, very serious 600-page novel, the end of which you might feel like you've been on a really interesting journey, but I don't think you'd feel significantly happier. Whereas Anansi Boys, I thought it would be really fun to write a book that would do that thing that a good Shakespearean comedy does, where you really enjoy being in the company of all these people. It's kind of fun. And when you get to the end, you feel happier than you were when you started.
And you've said that it grew out of the realization that there comes a time in most kids' lives when everything their parents do becomes embarrassing.
That's true. And that's one of those things that you get to go through first, of course, as a child. I can never forget the moment that my father decided that really healthy European shoes, roughly the shape and colors of very large bananas, were what he needed to wear for health reasons. And
but that is embarrassing, Neil.
I was 15. I used to try and walk far enough behind him on the pavement that nobody would know we were related, or at least even knew each other. But then you think that's embarrassing, and then suddenly here I am, and I'm the father of a girl, a little girl who, when she was 8, adored me and thought everything I did was cool, and suddenly she went sort of 9, 10, and I'm being informed that I need to park far enough away from the school that none of her friends will either be able to see the car she's driving or hear any of the music I'm playing, because, Dad, that's so embarrassing.
Your protagonist in this book, Charlie Nancy, is embarrassed by his father. But his father does things to embarrass him, like calling him Fat Charlie. He is a workaholic bookkeeper in London who is doing everything to forget his father, a womanizing, cheroot-smoking man who's carousing somewhere in Florida.
He is, yes. His father, Mr. Nancy, is an absolute rogue and very charming and deeply embarrassing. And
he even dies in an embarrassing way.
He dies in an embarrassing way. Yes, I mean, it's like he doesn't even... There are lots of not embarrassing ways to die. And Mr. Nancy could have picked any of those, but no, he has a heart attack singing karaoke. And on his way, as he topples from the stage, he reaches out a desperate final arm in one desperate gesture and accidentally grabs the tube top of a lady tourist and exposes her bosom to the world, which is something that Fat Charlie, even thinking about, it makes his toes curl.
So how does Fat Charlie learn that his father had actually been the human form of Anansi, the African trickster god?
It's after the funeral. He's talking to his next-door neighbor, Mrs. Higgler, and or the next-door neighbor when they were growing up, and she says, you've got to make allowances for your father because, after all, he was a god. And Fat Charlie says, no, he wasn't. You know, he wasn't a god. He was my dad. And she says, well, you can be both. You know, it happens. And he says, well, look, if my dad was a god, he would have had amazing godly magical powers. And she says, well, he did. How do you think he got away with not working all those years? And he says, well, look, if my dad had amazing godly powers and was a god, and I am the son of a god, shouldn't I have amazing godly powers? And she just looks at him and she says, oh, your brother got all that.
His brother Spider did get all of that. And Spider then arrives and does everything possible to destroy Charlie's life.
Well, he makes it more interesting. Spider is one of those people who doesn't really notice that other people really exist. He's just sort of, he's out there, he's utterly selfish, utterly amoral, and goes after the interesting things, which happen to include things like Fat Charlie's girlfriend.
Now, Anansi, the god, is where his father got the name Nancy. Is there really an Anansi?
Oh, yes. Anansi actually is a spider god who's also become a sort of trickster figure, starting out in West African folk tales, which were then spread to the Caribbean and to America. Further up the coast in West Africa, they told the same stories about Anansi about a rabbit, and those are the stories that we know today as the Br'er Rabbit stories.
The opening paragraphs will remind some readers of the beginning of the book of Genesis, not as a parody, but as a kind of a reimagining, I imagine. Did you mean it as a parody?
I didn't mean it as a parody, but I certainly meant it to hark back to every creation myth. I wanted to begin with a creation myth. Songs become incredibly important all the way through this book, beginning with, of course, the fact that Mr. Nancy gets to die singing karaoke and that Fat Charlie has a beautiful voice and is too embarrassed ever to sing. And so I decided to make a little creation myth up just about singing and about songs.
Anansi Boys may be an adult novel, but it has no sex, no obscenities to speak of. There's little in it that a 12-year-old couldn't read. On the other hand, I hear that the Graveyard book, your next children's book, begins with four pages of a serial killer walking around a house in the dark, having killed off all the family and looking for the baby to finish them all off.
It's quite true. You'd think that it ought to be... I have no idea why Anansi, which is an adult novel, and I think is justifiably an adult novel, happens to be completely sex and obscenity free, other than that I started out wanting to write a P.G. Woodhouse novel or a Thorne Smith novel, and they didn't have explicit sex or swearing, so I decided not to as well.
Now let's talk about the film Mirror Mask. You once were featured on a cover story in the Hollywood Reporter as being the only writer, the writer who's written the most stuff for films that never had been produced. Now, finally, we have a film that's produced, but this is not a Hollywood film.
No, although it's a sort of backdoor, upside-down, inside-out Hollywood film, but it's a very small, personal, handmade film. It's called Mirror Mask, and it began with a phone call from Lisa Henson, who is Jim Henson's eldest daughter, and she called me about 3 or 4 years ago and said, you know, we made these films back in the 80s that Jim Henson directed, Labyrinth and The Dark Crystal, And at the time, they were perceived as having been flops, but they'd gone on to just sort of be these films that are beloved by people, especially Labyrinth. Generation after generation watches that film and loves it, first on video and then on DVD. And she said, maybe we think maybe we could do another family fantasy film. And I said, what a great idea. And she said, but the drawback is that those films cost $40 million back in the 80s. And we only have $4 million. She said, so Dave McKean, your friend, the illustrator Dave McKean, I've seen some of his short films, which Dave had actually made in his mother's barn for nothing. And she said, and they're amazing, and they look fantastic, and I know that he made them for no money. She said, do you think Dave would be interested in directing a family fantasy film? And I said, I don't know, but I can ask him. And she said, well, I know that you couldn't write it because we can't afford you. And I said, no, if Dave says yes to directing it, I will write it.
Because you've collaborated on any number of other things that have been big successes. This film is about the opposite of what we would expect. Kids used to run away to join the circus. The twist here is that the teenage girl, played by Stephanie Leonidas, wants to run away from the circus owned by her family because she wants to join real life. And then she winds up being transported into the strange parallel world, which is even stranger than the world of today, which is pretty strange.
Yes, she gets to visit a sort of something that may be a dream and maybe something far odder and weirder than a dream. She's 15. She's just had a huge row with her mum, and then her mum gets very ill, and she winds up getting her wish. She gets real life. And suddenly the circus is off the road, but it's not on the road the way she wanted it. And that night, she has this peculiar experience. And it was, after that, we just let our imaginations go.
And made for $4 million, but it does not look like it. That's because, I guess, computers are now capable of doing some amazing things. I gather there's another, you're writing a script for Beowulf for a film that will cost probably $4 million just for the catering, but that's another matter. You have another film in the works, and you have any more comic books in the works?
Yes, there's lots of stuff in there. I mean, it's fun. I get to sort of keep going and dipping my hands in different things. Beowulf, by the way, is actually also going to be computer-generated, although
Robert Zemeckis.
With real actors. It's Robert Zemeckis using the same technique he pioneered with Polar Express.
Meanwhile, we have Anansi Boys just out from William Morrow, Miramask, opening tomorrow at the Landmark Sunshine on East Houston Street. Thank you so much, Neil Gaiman, for being on our show today.
Thank you so much.